is the podcast for Tuesday, May 10th, 2011, Contemporary Moral Issues. And we're just covering the last few items on the study guide. I did put a recording on Moodle. It's in the announcement section. There's a link to it there. And there's also some questions that help you go over the price gouging reading, which will be on the exam. So it's not on this printed sheet I handed out. There's only like four questions on the price gouging that I gave you. And those are in the announcement section, along with the supplemental recording I made after class on last Thursday. So the exam will be open through next Monday. And actually, I'm going to say it'll be through next Tuesday. So you can have till next Tuesday, because I've had like five people ask me if they could do it on Tuesday. We have class on Tuesday, so it'll be open through next Tuesday. Yes, sir?
I sent you a message on Sunday.
Oh, it's in the announcement section. So if you just click announcements in Moodle, you'll find it.
Okay.
It's also in the if you're looking for any of the recordings, there's a link in the top block that says podcasts and class notes or something like that. Here, I'll give you the exact name, but you can't miss it. It's in the very top of Moodle. Podcast notes and handouts. Okay, so yeah. Who does he mean the instructor target is guilty of greed? And it's people that want unearned money through checking a box on a ballot. So you have people that say, hey, there's all these rich fat cats who have all this money. I want some of it. I know what I'll do. I'll get band together with a bunch of my other layabout friends, and we'll just check boxes on ballots, and we'll have all the money we want. I'll get free health care from the government. I'll get a nice retirement package. Because they got plenty, and I don't got squat. And so, I mean, to me, that's greedy. Like, if you're a businessman, if you're offering products and services that people are buying on a voluntary basis, that's providing a community service. Trying to skim off the top of those people without giving them anything in return, that seems like greed to me. But usually people say, oh, the greedy corporations, the evil greedy corporations, they're killing with low prices and wide selection, and they're making me buy their crap. Well, nobody's making you buy their crap. If it's crap, don't buy it. You know, so you think about what is greed, it's an inordinate desire for wealth. Well, people that want something for nothing and want it at someone else's expense, that seems to be a description of greed. Why should you be aware of college professors? Because they typically go straight from being a student to being a professor. They've never held like a real job, and even the economics professors are just going off theory books that they picked up in college, written by people that work in government institution. We're all unionized government employees. So when you have a professor, particularly one of political science or sociology, telling you that, like I heard one today saying, oh, well, we can't let the banks fail, otherwise the whole economy would collapse. We can't let these big insurance corporations go down, or the whole economy would collapse, it would be terrible. So what do we need to do? Bail out big corporations that fail. That's a recipe for disaster. But why does that person believe that? Well, it's because that's what his other egghead friends believe, who've never held a job in the private sector and view economics through this narrow prism of certain untested and actually falsifiable theories in academia about economics. Founding fathers, if you read the founding fathers, they all thought that property rights were as sacred as the laws of God. So they're a bunch of religious wackos as well. And they all thought that property rights are you have right to life, liberty, and property. They got that straight out of John Locke. Property rights were seen as something that was really, really important, because your property is the fruit of your labor. It belongs to you. And the government can only take it in very extreme circumstances. For example, if they need to build a bridge, and your house is right there where they need to build that bridge, or you're being attacked by some foreign country, and they need to raise money for the army. So those were the only cases in which they thought that people could be taxed, and also they had some important export taxes and to help support things like infrastructure, like ports and bridges and so on. So there were a few taxes, but they're really, really small. And the revolution was, you know, the American Revolution was no taxation without representation. And people went wacko over, like, a few taxes on sugar, tea, and legal documents and print publications. And people, and having to put up soldiers in your house for the night if they're coming through. And people thought that was tyranny. Tax Freedom Day is a day that your average American stops working for the government and starts working for himself. So the average person, and let me just look at the, let me just find the actual day.
Is that, do you mean that all the money up to that day that you made that year goes to taxes?
Right.
Supposedly.
Here it is. So this is based on the average person. So again, in our heavily graduated tax system, one of the planks of the Communist Party, in our heavily graduated tax system, you know, some people pay nothing, other people pay, you know, 70%. So, okay, April 12th. Wow, it's actually come back a little bit. So basically, you're working almost till tax day, to April 12th. So that's, you know, 4.5 months of the year you're working supporting the government. After April 12th, you're working for yourself. Again, this is an average of all Americans. And so if the founding fathers look at that, they would just go nuts. They'd say it's time for an armed revolution, an insurrection. And that's why they believed in, that's why they put the Second Amendment in there. One of the reasons is that the government gets out of control, people have guns to have an armed resistance. So I'm not advocating armed resistance. I'm just talking about attitude. So they thought property rights really, really important, taxes really, really bad, and property rights were seen as fundamental. Who pays most of the taxes in America? It's people on the top. The top earners pay most of the taxes. So your people making over $250,000 pay the lion's share of the taxes. So what do the people at the bottom pay? Well, the bottom 47% don't pay anything. And some of those people even get money back. So, and I'm sure there's people in this room, you have like an earned income tax credit or something, you're getting, you actually, they take money out of your paycheck, and you get this big lump sum after you do your taxes, and sometimes it's bigger than it's more than the money you paid in. So you're actually making money on taxes. So who doesn't pay? People are at the very bottom. What is laissez-faire capitalism? That's just an extreme form of capitalism where the government doesn't intervene in the economy at all. You could just call it pure capitalism. Laissez-faire just means let it be, and so or let it go. So that so laissez-faire just means sometimes laissez-faire is, you know, it's French. Laissez-faire is just let the economy do its thing and government stay out of it. Collectivism is this idea that the group is the primary unit of society. That's, people only have value in being part of a group. Individuals have no inherent worth. And you get this in socialism, this idea that you're part of a community and the community takes front seat, you take the back seat. You get this in fascism too. It's just the language is different. You're a cog in the corporate state machine. Capitalism is the idea of free exchange, that individuals own businesses. They can get a bunch of investors and form a corporation, but it's groups of individuals cooperating together, and they own the means of production. Karl Marx said that capitalism leads to the exploitation of workers. That's his essential idea, that people become wage slaves, they become beholden to the evil corporate master who makes them into slaves and tells them what to do and pays them what he wants. So it exploits the work.
Will you say what collectivism was again?
Collectivism is that the group is the primary unit of value, that individuals have no worth except as part of a group. Like as an American. As an individual, I have no worth. But as an American, or maybe as a member of like a state or city or an ethnic group, maybe, I have value. But as an individual, I don't have any value in the collectivist view. And I should think about how can, and this is this idea, how can I serve humanity? And I take the point of a servant. I'm a servant of the community. I have to give back. I'm the last presidential campaign. Both Barack Obama and John McCain talked about public service. You're a servant of the state. John McCain, country first. He has a sort of patriotic, militaristic, nationalist view of country first. And some people might say jingoistic. And then Barack Obama has this kind of community organizing idea, community organizer, more kind of socialist idea of spread the wealth around and redistribute income. And this idea that you need to pay your fair share, to support everybody else. And the idea that we're all in this together and we all ought to function as a group, not as individuals. And so that's this idea of collectivism. The Founding Fathers were all individualists. And they gave us a constitution of individual rights, not group rights. The idea of group rights is even problematic. But so collectivism is this idea that the group is what matters, individuals don't matter, except as they're part of a group. And then the economic system, which goes along with that, socialism, says that from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. That you throw all the money in a big pile, and then the elites sort it out and decide who gets who and make sure that everything's fair.
Was that the slogan that we were supposed to be writing down at the end of what you just said?
Right, that's Karl Marx's slogan.
Could you repeat it?
From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. And that should all be in your notes. This is a review. So, class struggle is a struggle between economic classes. So it's the struggle, Marx says, our current struggle is about from the economic classes of the proletariat, who is the worker, and the bourgeoisie, who is the business owner. So it's between workers and business owners, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. Why wasn't there a worldwide worker revolution? It's because of the rise of the middle class. Marx did not foresee the rise of the middle class. He didn't understand that a rising tide lifts all boats, and that fat cat businessman was providing good salaries to get the best workers, and that capitalism was producing increasing efficiency, more leisure time, and so when you're producing more efficiently, you have more money washing around the economy, and pretty soon that factory job is giving you a pretty darn good wage, and you get a bigger house, and all these consumer goods which are coming out of the factory that you can buy now, and pretty soon you got people with plasma screens and VCRs and cell phones, and it's all cool. And Marx just saw that the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, you didn't have the Industrial Revolution was still sort of in progress. And so you did have this disparity of rich and poor. But as society got more and more advanced and more manufactured goods help people save labor and time, labor becomes less important and people have more wealth. And so Marx didn't foresee the rise of the middle class.
Let's see.
Why isn't communism scalable? Well, because communism, where it works with relationships. It works in small communities. So like a family. You might think about a family as being a communal group, right? Now, often you'll have like a patriarch, but once especially children become teenagers, there's a little push and pull, and sometimes you have authoritarian parents. But like my family, we didn't have like a list of rules and chores to do. And, we did things by consensus. And my mom and dad, it's not like my dad was sort of this patriarch that and my mom was always in the kitchen. They both had jobs. They both divvied up the chores. And I had certain things that I'd like to do. I'd mow the lawn, do the vacuuming and the laundry and the dishes. My other brothers would do other things like, the sort of work on the, help my dad working in the garage and the cars. And so we had different things we divvied out. But there's no, we didn't have a government or set of formal rules. We just get things as a group with that. But that works, until you get 50 or 100 people, and all of a sudden you start needing rules, because it's really difficult to manage groups of hundreds of people, let alone thousands or millions.
Well,
you can't do that.
Because,
yeah, and then you don't know anybody, right? In a big city, you're just like an anonymous guy, and maybe you know your neighbors, maybe you don't. I mean, I've lived places where I didn't know my neighbors' names. Whereas if you're in a small town or community, it can kind of work. But when you're talking about millions of people, there aren't those relationships. Because you can't have relationships with millions of people. And so you need some rules of conduct. Which of any of the major goals of the Communist Manifesto have been implemented in American society today? So a lot of them. The graduated tax system, or sometimes called the progressive tax system. All right, we got that. Public schools, we got that. Government schools. Abolition of child labor, we got that too. Maybe the commies weren't all bad. So those things, we went through in detail those things on the last page of the handout, how to some extent most of those things have been implemented in our society. A central bank is a big one. The Federal Reserve is a central bank in the United States.
Off track, sorry. Which handout are you talking about?
It's the capitalism and socialism. It was like the big one that says who guards the guardians on the top.
Oh, I have that one too. Okay.
Yeah, it's on the back, last page of the who guards the guardians.
I have a question. On your supplemental podcast, you mentioned something about the internet kill switch.
Oh, yeah.
What's that?
So centralization of all communication, right? So this is pre-internet, right? Obviously, it's the 19th century. So it says you should have centralization of communications. Well, we don't have communications all being controlled by the government, but now there's this idea of an internet kill switch that the government could shut off the internet in case of national emergency. That's probably going to pass, I'll guess. You'll get the net neutrality fanatics who want like a communist type internet, and you'll get the national security conservatives who want like the fascist internet, and the two of them will get together and say, okay, let's let the government turn off the internet. One group will say to fight the terrorists, and the other group will say to have more government control over the internet. So coming to a workstation near you. Where are we at?
What would shutting off the internet do, though?
The idea is if we're under cyber attack, it would just keep people. Or if there's, rioting in the streets. I mean, this is the fascist nations in the Middle East having the ability to do that.
From the internet that everybody found out what was really going on.
Yeah. That's true. So a lot of those, almost all of those, to some extent or other, have been, I talked about, some of them not all the way, like the tax on immigrants, but there's a new millionaire tax on people that want to leave the country. They have a lot of money. And actually, you don't have to be a millionaire. You have to make a certain amount, like a few hundred thousand dollars every year for the last 5 years, and you'd have to pay a big chunk of that to the government if you want to decide to be a citizen of another country. So capitalism and socialism are on a continuum, which means that there is no purely capitalist country and there is no purely socialist country. Every country is kind of a mixture. Now, some are way more towards the socialist side, like North Korea. Some have been socialist for a long time, like China, but they've moved in the capitalist direction. And then some have been more capitalist for a long time, like America, which is moving more in the socialist direction. And so every economy today is what they call a mixed economy. So, and there's varying degrees of socialism and capitalism. The Germans are more capitalist than the French, and the British are more capitalist than the Germans. Well, actually, that's the other way around. But let's see, the Germans are most capitalist, followed by the French. Followed by the British, followed by the French. So I won't ask you details about particular countries, but just know that, that there's varying degrees of capitalism and socialism. And know, even Cuba is moving more towards the capitalist side now. Yeah.
Well, I mean, isn't it fair to say that if we have a Republican in office, we're going to be more capitalist, and when we have a Democrat in office, we're going to be more socialist in our country?
Generally speaking, like, you know...
Isn't that our balance, I mean, for the most part?
I say that Bush was kind of a fiscal socialist. He busted the budget, but then, like, you know, Barack Obama has a deficit that's more in a single month than we have in a whole year in one of the Bush years. But yeah, it's generally true. But, you know, Bush added Medicare Part D.
Capitalism is a bad thing.
So Bush added a Medicare entitlement. You have free drugs for geezers as part of the new Medicare entitlement for old people. If you're a millionaire and you manage to reach the age of 63, 65, whatever it is, you get, you know, low cost or subsidized drugs from the government. Well, who did that? Well, George W. Bush, a supposed capitalist. And this just shows that, someone you think about as being a conservative, he's, you know, it's not like there was ever a pure capitalist in office. And some people came close, like maybe Howard Taft or, Calvin Coolidge, come pretty close, and the Founding Fathers. Ron Paul. I mean, Ron Paul is pretty much it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, Walter, we're explaining to my office, listening to radio, well, yesterday at work, and I guess Bush's brother was in the textbook industry during the whole Literature Left Behind Act. Mm-hmm. Basically, all these testing, the kids got, you know, each test cost $30, and that was all in his pocket. So
that's just plain old graft and corruption. I'm looking for a dig at the Republicans. So I'd say that, again, so it's the continuum is the main thing. Don't want to get off on a tangent here. Russian blogger. So this Russian blogger, I gave you this to see, like, what do the Russians think about us? And, like, the Russians think we're nuts because they think, well, we tried this, like, communist experiment, and it didn't work. Who believes in communism? Like, you know, my doddering old father-in-law who wants to go back to the old days of the secret police and bread lines. And now they look over at America and they see that we're moving away from capitalism towards socialism, and they don't understand it. And they have like a flat tax, and their economy is doing pretty well and booming. They don't have huge debt piling up over trillions of dollars every year. And this blogger is expressing the sort of, I think, view of the Russian man in the street about America moving in the socialist direction. Although now kind of tacking back to the other side with the last elections and the Republicans taking the House and the Tea Party movement and all that. So it's, you know, back and forth, back and forth. I'm not going to say that everything that person says is accurate. So this is I thought it'd be good to have the view of a person from another country looking in. Pravda is really good for that. As well as like the British papers. I do not endorse the Scurllo's comments about homosexuals. That was that he had sandwiched in there about America's. He had something about gay marriage or something like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, world poverty. So, the Eugene City tax. So. The arguments against the Eugene City income tax, 25% of the people that have kids in the Eugene schools they live outside of the city. They live in the district outside the city. So 25% of the people who are benefiting from the schools aren't going to be paying this tax. And then there are other arguments that they pay enough people pay enough taxes already, property tax, state income tax, and it's all going to education, and all mostly K-12.
So 25% of people, they're in district but out of city limits.
Right,
they don't
exactly.
Have to pay the school tax.
Right.
Okay.
They can raise it at any time, just through a simple majority vote. And they can raise it at any time. And then the fourth main argument, let's see. The fourth argument is that there's other ways to close the gap, like not paying the PERS contribution. So they talked a lot about that the school district right now kicks in 60% towards teacher and administrator retirements. And they don't have to pay that 6% could close the gap. 6% PERS payment could balance the budget. PERS, that's the retirement system. So they said you could just balance the budget with the PERS tax. Also, they said it would take a whole bunch of money to raise the tax because we don't have any mechanism for collecting the tax. I think those were all the main arguments. That the school district could lay off a bunch of administrators. They have a whole lot of administrators there that aren't teaching. We could get along with just fine without just fine. Okay, world poverty. So in the United States, the main problem with the poor is obesity. And in third world countries, it's getting enough calories to eat and getting enough vitamins so your eyes don't degenerate, so you're not blind by the time you reach adulthood. And dying of preventable diseases that everybody gets inoculations for in the United States. That happens in the third world. So
America is obesity, third world countries is starving.
Starvation, actually. There's actually people starving.
Right.
Also, when people say things like, oh, well, there are people starving in this country. And I like to say, well, point to one. Right? Sometimes you get some religious wacko who's out in his shack with his family, and he's, you know, too proud to take welfare or help from his friends at church, and he's like holed up there waiting for the end, and one of his kids dies of starvation. Well, that's just child abuse. That guy's, you know, got some mental problems. And there's people, you know, like that terrible case of child abuse that we talked about in this class. That was one of my last classes. There was a girl that was like beaten and starved over a long period of time. Oh, that was last term.
That's horrible. My kids don't eat for half an hour and they freak out. I don't understand.
Yeah.
So
there's nobody starving. I mean, in the third world countries, you'll see bodies by the road. There's really people dying of starvation. You'll see a vulture hanging over, following a child waiting for him to
Wouldn't
die.
Would emaciation be a good word?
Yeah. So that's the difference between absolute and relative. Relative poverty is like, I got these hand-me-down jeans that don't fit, and that kid in the class next to me has these designer jeans, and I'm really jealous that I don't have what he has. I have to stand by the road, and actually it's a bad way to get money. You see that like panhandler guy out on the I-5 exit? I don't know if anybody comes from the south besides me. There's some guy that has like a sign, he's been there like every day, cold and hungry, please help. And like, you know, that guy hasn't died yet. People apparently are giving him money, right? So I mean, in third world countries, literally you have people that are like wandering out in the desert with nothing to eat. They rely on Western relief agencies. They have a drought or something, or all their crops are gone. There's people in North Korea right now, which is a semi-industrialized, backwards communist nation. But at least they're like an event. They have nuclear weapons. But there's people that are like boiling grass and bark to eat because they had their crop didn't come in. And there's going to be, last time this happened, like tens of thousands of people died from not getting enough food. Let's see. Lifeboat ethics is this idea of just letting people starve in other countries because helping them will do no good. It creates overpopulation, and then it siphons resources from our own country.
What was that?
Lifeboat ethics says you shouldn't give away a bunch of money to suffering people because you're going to hurt yourself. It's like if you let too many people into the boat, the boat's going to sink. So just let them drown. And Steve Savage, our guest, said, well, this might sound good in the abstract, but if you think about what if it was your parents or your children, you'd be singing a different song. So this idea of charity starts at home, again, it has to do with the extremes of poverty. And you might think that people that need the most help, or people who need help the most, should get the lion's share of the help. Bob and his Bugatti is an example that shows that a rich person might have to make a lot of sacrifice to save a single life. That you might be more, it tries to establish the principle you're required to make a huge sacrifice to save a single life. We think that anybody who favored their sports car over a child that's going to be run over by a train would be a bad person. If they said, well, that child's going to have to die, so my sports car remains pristine. But then, you know, that if you have $200,000 sitting around in the bank and not doing anything with it, there's children who are starving to death who, you know, would otherwise live without your help. And then Doran or TV is meant for people that say, well, I'm poorer than dirt. I can't afford anything. Well, Dora gets like $300 for hooking up the street urchin with some people who claim that they're an orphanage, but really later on she realizes they're going to like steal his organs for a transplant. And so she feels really bad and tries to get him back. And Seeger makes the point that even, you know, if you have petty cash sitting around, that's going to help too. And so you can't say, well, I don't have any means to help people. Almost everyone has some means to help, even if it's modest. That doesn't get you off the hook. Yeah.
So in this conversation with Danny Underwater, he's with a friend of mine, he was saying, you know, if I was in that position, that was a pretty good idea. Because if I was in that position, I knew a place, established the business, and say, hey, buy me a bucket, squeegee, I'll wash your windows, and go on to the next business, I'll wash their windows for $25. And that, you know, by the end of the day, I made $100.
Assuming people will pay you and not worried about the IRS coming after them for doing office labor or something. But yeah. So
it's still better than just sitting on the street corner.
Yeah, I agree. I'm about ready to stop to ask, tell that guy to go to the mission and give us some bus fare or something. Like that's what they're for. So we should move on here though. What does Charles Krauthammer propose? Free trade and economic development. Yeah.
I also want to say, on the same regard, wasn't there something about the New Deal back in the day and how it happened a lot of unemployed people to work?
Yeah, and it prolonged the Depression. So, and this is an earlier question about how do historians misread history. When you create a bunch of make-work jobs, all you're really doing is you're paying 100 people to dig dishes and the other 100 to fill it up, but they're not doing something productive. Now, how do you know that it's productive? Well, you know, I suppose if you're building roads and bridges that you're going to get some use out of and you're going to build anyway, that's something. But a lot of the New Deal work was just a bunch of government money to keep people employed so they could buy things, which is ridiculous because that money has to come from somewhere. But Charles Krauthammer says free trade and globalization will save the third world. And it's leading to large middle classes in India and China. And lifting millions of people out of poverty. Free trade and globalization. Steve Savage established a school for poor kids in Darfur. And he talked about the collateral damage worldview, which is just to say, it's too bad, but what can I do? And to sort of not do anything. So that the collateral damage worldview is to say it's too bad, but what can I do? And to not do anything instead of trying to do something. To say, well, it's just the way of the world, there's nothing I can do about it. Well, there is something you can do about it. You can't save every person, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't try to save one or a handful or whatever you can do. Okay. Price gouging questions. What's wrong with price gouging according to Snyder? Well, it fails to respect persons. He says it fails to respect persons as persons. And And he thinks that if you have additional costs, it's okay to raise your prices. So if you're trucking a bunch of equipment from overseas or out of state, you can raise the price a little bit. But he thinks there ought to be like government regulations on how much you can raise your price and for necessities. And so So he thinks it's okay to add in a little bit more if you have an additional cost, but that's the only justification. And he thinks the government should be determining prices in the wake of emergencies.
Who's he?
Snyder.
Thank you.
So when it says, what does he propose? Government.
He proposes government regulations on how much you can charge.
For essential goods and services.
For essential goods and services, right. And he would say that that price gouging is only bad if it interferes with fair access to essential goods. So there's two elements there: fair access. Can you get to the essential goods, and they have to be essential goods. So, you know, if you price gouge on a tanning salon, that's fine, right? So, or you price gouge on popcorn at the movies, he thinks that's okay. It's only wrong to price gouge if you do it for essential goods like food and water, and you're doing that in the wake of a disaster, and it interferes with people's ability to get at it. So like if you just have a supermarket and your price is too high, somebody will just drive down the street and buy from somebody else. But in the wake of disaster, when supplies are scarce, you can't do that. So price gouging is wrong when it interferes with fair access to essential goods. Zwolinski says that price gouging is good. Why is price gouging good? Well, it makes people ration themselves and only buy what they need. So if you know there's a hurricane coming, people will go into a store and they'll buy like 12 packs of batteries and 20 gallons of water so they can hunker down. They get way more than they need. But if they see that the water is like $10 a gallon, they're not going to buy 20 gallons. Maybe they'll just buy 5 gallons, or maybe they'll buy 3 gallons. They'll take what they need. And that higher price is going to keep people from going crazy and emptying the store shelves, and that's going to mean that there's going to be enough for everyone. And so he thinks that the raising prices actually has a beneficial effect.
What about bringing the market back?
Right. So the other thing is that once the disaster's over, it makes prices go to normal more quickly.
Well, doesn't it also bring in resources that wouldn't otherwise be there?
Right. So that's the third thing, is it brings in resources which otherwise wouldn't come. So if I think I'm going to make a killing on water purifiers, I'm going to bring all my water purifiers, and there's going to be a supply of water purifiers there that wouldn't have been there if I were not motivated by my greedy capitalist inclinations. His non-worseness claim is that it can't be wrong to sell something to someone at a high price if you wouldn't have been there to sell it at a lower price. So it can't be wrong to sell someone something at a very high price if they would have been worse off if you weren't there in the first place. So the idea is that you can say, well, that's really, you're like a, you know, it's really mean for you to charge that much money for that price. It's immoral. And you might say, well, am I obligated to like go out and buy a bunch of stuff, put it on a truck, and like drive to some disaster area and give stuff away? Well, no. Okay. Well, what? I might say, well, if I'm not going to make a bunch of money, I'm just not going to do it. So if I hadn't been greedy and hadn't planned on price gouging, I wouldn't have been selling the stuff in the first place. So how can you say it's wrong for me to sell at a high price? So it's this idea that it's no worse to sell something at a high price than not to sell it to someone at all.
As long as there is no moral obligation.
Yeah, I suppose you might say there's a moral obligation to get
stuff. And what would you call that?
That's the NWC non-worseness claim.
Thank
NWC.
You.
Can
you say what
that
NWC is?
So the NWC, or non-worseness claim, is that it can't be immoral to sell something at a high price if you otherwise wouldn't have sold it at all. It can't be immoral to sell something at a high price if you otherwise wouldn't have sold it at all.
You're saying that like, you wouldn't have the service anyways if I wasn't selling it. Let's say that I know the price is high, but I probably wouldn't be here, and this service wouldn't be offered if I wasn't selling it anyways, right?
Yeah, so I say, really, $20 for a water purifier? And I say, hey, well, the only reason I'm here, I'm selling for $20. If I couldn't sell them for $20, I'd be doing something else. And you'd be drinking that, you know, contaminated water. So it's like, and if the guy is willing to pay $20, then...
Ain't that bad off then.
Okay. So that's it for review. Any other questions about it?
Cool, I guess.
Are you going to, like, how much are you going to deviate from the review? Very much? A little bit? Kind of, sort of?
I mean, there'll be things in the review that don't end up on the test because the test is only 50 questions. I can't think of anything that's on the, that's not on the review in some form.
Price gouging? This is it?
Yeah, it's pretty much at the main, hitting the main points.
Do we still get our note card?
You still get your note card front and back?